The move from the flats in James Street, tiny flats with oil lamps, to Hillside Avenue was like, it was like moving to heaven. Hillside Avenue, this new estate the council were building, were rows of semi-detached houses, and they were built in fours. Four of them were what were called kitchen type, and the next four were parlour type. And then kitchen type four, parlour type four, right throughout the estate. The difference being, there was one more room, a lounge, or as the work called in those days, a parlour. And we moved into number 31 in the first length of houses to be built on what was previously just open country. Now, when you went in the door, immediately on your left was the staircase up to the bedrooms. On your right-hand side was the door into the lounge, or, as I've just mentioned, parlour, as we called them in those days. At the end of the hallway was another door. You went through this door into quite a good-sized kitchen, a square, quite a really big kitchen, really. And off the kitchen was a small pantry with shelves so that you could put groceries, whatever, what have you. And it had a little window too in the store. And from the kitchen there was a doorway right into the living room, or as we called them in those days, the kitchen, which was another quite a big square-shaped room with an iron range and open fire there, with the oven on one side and the hob on the other side, and you'd done your cooking by the coal fire. Then on the left-hand corner of this kitchen was a door which led you into a little passageway. There were two doors there. The one to the right led you out down a couple of steps into the garden. The one on the left opened to show quite a good-sized coal store where you could hold quite a few hundredweights of coal. And immediately facing the door from the kitchen was another square-shaped room, which was a wash house with a metal wash boiler in, which was lighted by gas, or fueled by gas, for the woman to do her washing in. It was quite a big room too. Then at the front there was a small garden, fenced off with the chestnut pile fencing. And in the rear there was quite a decent sized garden, which it wasn't long before my father with the rest of the family had it was all laid out and shaped up and planted with vegetables and flowers. Of course the vegetables were a big help, cut the cost of living in those days. My father grew potatoes and cabbage and peas, cauliflowers, even melons, and we had red currant and black currant bushes, gooseberry bushes, so it was a big help towards the family budget. And it was a nice place to go and sit. We had deck chairs which we used to be able to sit there. But the main thing was the upstairs, where there were three bedrooms and a bathroom and an inside toilet. It was marvellous to have those facilities. And then the crowning glory was electric light. Just press the switch and turn the lighting on. And they were quite reasonable rents. I can still remember the rent my parents paid for that house was 12 and sixpence a week. That's in old money. That would be 75 pence a week in a present day rates of coinage. And for the electric light, you paid 1 and sixpence a week in the winter and 9 pence a week in the summer. That was in old money. But the only thing was, there was a limit to how much electricity you could use. You could have, I can't recall exactly how many lights. Whether it was 3 or 4 lights, rooms lit up, that I just can't recall. But for argument's sake, say you had a light in the living room and one in the kitchen and one in a bedroom. If someone went into the bathroom and switched the light on, every light in the house all flickered on and off quickly. They flashed on and off very quickly until someone put one of the lights off. So there was like a limit to how many lights you could have or rooms you could have lit up at the one time. But still, it was good value, and we were really amazed at the difference. It was like living in a different world. And we soon made very good friends with all the neighbours. On the right-hand side was a family called the Jewels, Mr. and Mrs. Jewel, and next door a family named Kermode, and next door then were Crellens, and opposite were the Johnsons, and we soon got to know them all. And I got very friendly with a lot of the children. There were a large number of children on the estate. Jackie Newsom, and Jackie Christian, Georgie Gill, and Oliver McGrath, Ernie Kajin. We used to play games in the street. And then as the nights drew in, we used to all sit around the lamppost and tell stories. And used to get me to tell stories and tell them ghost stories and frighten them. And we were up to all sorts of capers, playing kick the tin. There were two old maid sisters who lived in one house there. I can't recall their name, but kiddies used to say they were two old witches. They weren't, of course. They were nice people, really, looking back. But children being cruel, used to get a length of cotton or a length of string and tie it to the door knocker and go and hide behind one of the hedges. Because all round the gardens there, we had this chestnut paling fencing and privet hedges on the inside. So they used to hide and then pull the string and make the door knocker go. Of course, one of these old ladies used to come out, see no one there. When she'd go back in, keep doing that until she finally wisened up, she'd come out and chase us. Oh, it was great fun. Of course, it was further to go to school, but one didn't mind in those days. No families had motor cars, so everybody had to walk or take the bus. Well, Hillside Avenue was off the bus route, so it was a case of walking. Used to walk to school and then walk home at dinner time and walk back and hope back home again at 4 o'clock. We didn't mind. And I still kept on at the church, St. Matthew's Church, until there was a change of the vicar change, and there was a man came who not very many people liked. He wasn't a very nice person. He called himself Father Watson. They reckoned he had been a missionary out in Africa, and he had a wooden leg. Anyway, one Sunday I went to a church service, and I'd fallen playing football or something, and my knee was very badly cut, and I had really bandaged. I couldn't bend the leg. I was sitting in the choir pew, and Father Watson was going on with the service, and he come to prayers, and he said, meekly kneeling upon our knees. Well, I couldn't kneel, so I had to sit in the seat and just lean forward. And he repeated this 3 times. I looked up and he was staring at me, and it really hurt me. He shouted, meekly kneeling upon our knees. I just got up and bowed my head in front of the altar and walked out of the church. I went home and told my parents, and they say, "Well, we won't bother going there anymore," and we never went back to St. Matthew's after that. There were quite a few people left because of Father Watson, because he started having a higher service with incense and all that sort of thing. It was all became almost a Catholic church, so a lot of people left. But they had a band, St. Matthew's Church had a band, and a pal of mine, I went to school with David Lewin, his father was the conductor of the band, so David joined, and his cousin Bill Partington, who'd been at school with us too, and we all joined. I learnt on the tenor horn, well, we all did, and changed to different instruments. I changed the trombone, and Bill Partington played trombone too, and David Lewin, I can't remember now, I think he played the cornet. Anyway, after a while I got a bit bored and I packed that up. But it was around about 1933, and I was crazy about music, listening to dance music and acting and watching the cinema. And there's a dancing school in Douglas at that time, in Selborne Drive. A lady ran it named Mrs. Rushworth. It was called the St. Albans School of Dancing. So David Lewin and I went there to learn how to tap dance, and they put a pantomime on at the Christmas, I think it was the 1933 pantomime, with local artists. It was called The Old Woman Who Lived in a Shoe. And there was a man, he was an electrician in Douglas. I can't recall his name now. It wasn't Wagstaff. But I just forget his name, but he was an electrician. He played the part of the old woman who lived in the shoe. But David Lewin and I, we sang a duet, dressed in rags, Underneath the Arches, the Flanagan and Allen song. That was 1933, I think that was. But during that time, around 1932, I had listened to the wireless regularly, and I first heard Bing Crosby. I heard this singer, and I absolutely fell in love with his voice right then. I wrote off to America for his autograph. He was just becoming known as a star at that time, and I became an avid fan of Bing Crosby. And I used to be going around singing there, Boo 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 Boo, and all his songs, until all the other lads, everyone, nicknamed me Bing. And so I became Bing Adams. And today, right up to this very day, but my 75th year, there's a few people meet me and still call me Bing. A lot of them didn't know me by any other name. And I'll never forget, at school, we had to write an essay on a famous person. We'd been been told stories of Drake, Nelson, and Rhodes, Clive of India, and all these. And so we were told that we had to write an essay on a famous man. And I wrote an essay on Bing Crosby. How his voice brought pleasure to millions and all that. And in the end, when Mr. Hardman gave out who he thought wrote the best essay, it was me, writing about Bing Crosby. And he said, "I've never heard of him, but it's a good essay." So that's how I came to be known as Bing, and I'm still as big a fan of Bing's today as ever I was then. And so life went on happy. It was such a happy place, the Isle of Man, in those days, in the 30s. The promenade, 2 miles long, from the pier to Derby Castle. There used to be a theatre there called Derby Castle, where Summerland stands today. and the main street was shopping, Strand Street. In the summertime, you could barely walk through the street. It was that crowded. And starting at Duke Street, going north through the street, there was a china shop, Dibb's China Shop, and an ironmonger's, Todd Hunterton Elliott's, quite a big shop it was. And then you come to the corner of Victoria Street, on the left-hand side was Boots Chemist. They had a big store here then, Boots. Later on, they packed up and left the island. What a great pity, but there is talk of them coming back now. And you cross Victoria Street, and the first place on your right-hand side was a beautiful cafe, little cafe, Miss Cannell's Cafe. They'd done the baking downstairs in the basement, but there was an iron grill on the pavement, and the bakehouse window used to be open, and these wonderful smells used to come up. Oh, it was gorgeous. And on a winter's day, if you stood there when the weather was cold, if you stood over this grill, the warmth from the bakehouse used to come up and warm your feet. As you stood and looked into the cafe window, the shop window, and all the cakes on display. And on the other corner was Burton's, the tailor's. And a bit further along was R.C. Kane's on the right-hand side, where my sister worked. And opposite, on the opposite side was another little cafe called the Cabin Cafe. There were quite a few cafes there, and a little bit. And the opposite corner to that was Tossie Cowan's dress shop. And then Collinson's Cafe, and then the other side of Collinson's Cafe was another part of Tossie Cowan's. On the right hand side was a Lucas's fruit shop, beautiful fruit, and a fish shop next door to it, owned by the same people. And then next door to that there was a kipper shop, Flynn's Kipper Shop. As you came into Strand Street proper, you passed Regent Street with the post office was. There was just a few yards along, there was a cafe there called Felice's Cafe. It was a great gathering place for people who used to go for ice cream. They were of Italian descent, the Felices. They made beautiful ice cream. On the left shop was a ladies' dress shop, Lyons. Further along you came to Crellin's Kipper Shop. Their kippers were beautiful. Well, my mother used to ask me to go for get kippers for her. She said, make sure you go in Crellin's Kipper Shop. But just before you came to that, there was a chip shop where you could buy fish and chips. It was a very narrow shop, but very long, with all tables down the side, and the chip making place at the back, and the fish fryer. It was called Macon's. They were very popular. Even in the winter time, when all the country people from Peel and Ramsey and Castletown came into Douglas, they used to always make for Macon's. On a Saturday lunchtime, it was full of people from out of town. The chips were so good, really good. And opposite Macon's and Crellin's Kipper Shop, in the mid-30s, they built a ballroom, a beautiful ballroom called the Palais de Danse. I can't remember exactly when it opened, it must have been about 34, 35. But I remember when it opened. The first band that played there was one of the ones I used to like on the radio. It was Charlie Coons and his Kasani Club Orchestra from London. He was an American pianist, and he was very well known for his style of piano playing. In his later life, he gave up the dance band and he played piano solos. He was on the radio very often and made loads of records. But quite a few good bands came to play there. there was Eddie Carroll and his music. He was the one who composed a good swing number called Harlem and quite a few other numbers. Another year there was Jack Hilton's band. He was one of the most famous of the British dance bands. And then Mantovani. He had a dance band before the war and he played at the Pally. Always remember him there. I think it was 1937 or 38. A friend of mine was the projectionist at the Strand Cinema, and I used to go on about with him quite a lot. And with him working every night, many nights, I used to go up in the projection room and watch and have a chat with him. And he used to get free tickets into the Pally to dance, of course. And on Sunday nights, instead of dancing, they used to have concerts. So Gary Barton, that was his name, he usually had Sunday night off, so I used to go to the concerts at the Pally to dance with him. And at the summer season that Mantovani was there, he played the band also played quite the numbers, and then he would play a few solos. And he came to one solo, which is called Chardas. It's a well-known violin solo. And the first night we went, first Sunday we saw him, he picked his violin up and he stood there and the pianist struck up. And then he looked as if he was going dizzy, wiped his head, got his handkerchief out and wiped his forehead and put it back in his pocket, got ready again. He'd done that about three times before he finally played the tune. And of course he got an ovation when he finished. Now, a couple of Sundays later we went to see them again. And exactly the same tune, Chardas, when he went to play a solo, the same thing happened. It was all a gimmick. We went about four times that summer season, and every time, of course he was playing the right, during the summer season, the different people coming to these concerts every week. But that was part and parcel of showmanship, I suppose, that show business, as they say. And then the year that war broke out, 1939, it was a band called Jack Hart. Now, Jack Hart was born on the Isle of Man, but he became a musician and went to London, and he had an orchestra playing at the Kit Kat restaurant in London. Now, he was playing at the Pally the year the war broke out, in 1939. A few doors from the Pally to dance was the Picture House, which had a cinema organ. The chap coming up and playing the organ, changing colours. On a Sunday night, when there was only one house, before the film started, they used to put the words on the screen. This chap played the organ and we had a sing-song. Oh, very enjoyable. Opposite this Picture House was Woolworths. It's still there, Woolworths. Next door to Woolworths was a small fruit shop, Johnny Robinson's. It was only a small shop, but now, in present day, they seem to be the only fruiterers on the island. They seem to have the monopoly of the island. But then it was a small shop with Mr. Robinson and his wife serving there. And my birthday present from my father, every year when I was a tiny lad, he used to take me to Johnny Robinson's and get me 2 and 6 pence worth of fruit. And Mr. Robinson, he knew me father, of course, and myself, and he's given me a big bag of fruit. That's another happy memory. But just past Woolworths on the corner of Howard Street was a well-known tobacconist shop, Newsom's Tobacconist. And there used to be a man, I think it was the son of the chap who owned the shop. His name was Roy Newsom. And he was an absolute double of Maurice Chevalier, the French film star, with a big bottom lip. He went in a few competitions and won prizes as a double of Maurice Chevalier. He was exactly the same build and identical looks. On the opposite corner of Howard Street, there was the Maypole, where a lot of people used to go for their butter and margarine and tea, etc. And all the tea was, the butter was all in blocks there, and the assistants with wooden scoop shaper things, they used to cut a piece off and then shape it up into little blocks, finish up with like ridges across the butter. I always remember that. And they weighed it in front of you. It was a very popular shop, the Maypole. And opposite the Maypole was the Strand Cinema. That's where my friend was, the projectionist. I spent half my life around that cinema, I think, when I was in my teens. Just a bit further on, from on the right-hand side, there was a large hall. No furnished or anything, just an open front, and at the far end was a stage with a piano on. And that was Lawrence Wright's. In those days, of course, they weren't pop charts and all that. There was no television, just the radio, and of course, they had what they called song pluggers. They used to sell sheet music of all songs and tunes that were published by Lawrence Wright. And they had a woman playing, well, it was a man there at Lawrence Wright. He played the piano on the stage, and they had like a teacher's easel with song sheets over it, all the popular songs of the day of that year. And they had a chap with a stick there, and he would be pointing out the words of the song. A couple of other chaps would be going amongst the crowd selling sheet music, sixpence a copy, and they used to have little blue books with the words of all the song hits of that year in, which they used to sell for sixpence. Quite often they would get youngsters to go up on stage and sing for them. I went up myself many times. I used to love it. I used to love to go up there and sing the pop songs and do a bit of Bing Crosby. And they used to be absolutely packed, especially if it was a wet day when the holidaymakers were walking around in the rain. They used to crowd the song halls. There was another one further along the street. And past Lawrence Wright's song hall, there was a couple of pubs, the Old Strand Inn and the New Strand Inn, and a little pork butcher's shop there. Gray's, they used to call the chap who was in there Porky Gray. I'm not sure there's still a shop there. I haven't been down the town for ages. And opposite was a little tobacco shop a Cockney man used to have there. His name was Bert Ralphs, and he used to appear in concerts doing monologues. He was very, extremely good with Bert, and he was an extremely good pianist. He had a little dance band, which I appeared with a few years later. And further along, there was another fish shop, an open fish shop, very, very well patronised. The man there who owned it used to wear a straw caddy hat and a dicky bow. Higgins, Mr. Higgins, the fish shop. He had all sorts of haddocks and fish hanging up on hooks and lovely marble slabs with beautiful fish, fresh fish on. And just past him on the other side of the street was a gents outfitter, Fred Brideson's. Brideson the Hatter, they called him. And outside the shop he used to have things, hats and things hanging, but he had two hats hanging outside his shop which used to draw a lot of attention. One was a bowler. It would be the size of a good sized bucket. And there was another one, very, very tiny. Could put your hand around it and hold it in your hand, the whole hat. And he had a big sign outside saying, "Hats to fit all heads." And that was his advert. He had a son and a daughter, and his son was very friendly with my sister Connie for quite a while, George Bridgeton. And a bit further along there, just a few shops along, there was a tripe shop, a little tiny shop. Oh, the window would only be, well, the width of the whole shop would only be about 8 foot. And they sold, it was a woman. She used to go to St. Matthew's Church when we went. Miss Christian, tripe dresser. That's all she sold was tripe. You never see a tripe shop these days. And then a couple of doors from her was a baker's shop, Shimmons. But I think it was Percy Shimmon, the baker's. And that my mother used to send me regularly on a Saturday to this shop. Shimmons, the baker's there. He made a beautiful jam sponge, about the size of a good-sized dinner plate. And there were ninepence with beautiful raspberry jam in and white icing sugar dusted on the top. We had one of those every Sunday for tea. I had to go on a Saturday to that shop for that. Next door to that was the other song hall, and that was called Feldman's. And it was a similar place to Lawrence Wright's, just a big empty hall with a stage and a grand piano on and the easel with the song sheets on. But a woman played the piano there, quite a fat woman, and she was quite a good singer. I was told that she was a relation of Florrie Ford, the very popular singer of the 20s. She was a cousin or something, or so I was told anyway. Maybe it was just a tale, but she had a good voice and she could sing, belt a song out as good as Florrie Ford. Then just past that, on the corner of the street, the next street, was a butcher's shop, Tinker's the Butcher's. Well, then you come to Castle Street, and there was quite a lot of fancy goods shops in Castle Street, and leather goods shops, and there was an outfitter's there, Draper's, Percy Dawson's. He was a very popular shop. They had a lot of children's clothes there too. He played football for Wanderers with my brother. And so you come along to the end of the main shopping area, to the promenade, where there's the Sefton Hotel and then the Gaiety Theatre, real old theatre. And then the Villa Marina with some shops in an arcade. The Villa Marina had dancing and shows. And then there was a road to the left, Broadway, which took you up the top of the town. Further along you went, there was the Crescent Cinema. It was built in the 30s. Inside, it was just like being sitting in the courtyard of a medieval castle. Always felt cold in there. It was a vast place inside. And then there was a little pavilion called the Crescent Pavilion, where they used to have like a period show or concert party playing. And a couple of rows off Empress Drive and Mona Drive, and you come to Castle Mona Hotel, that was once the home of the Duke of Athol. And past that was the Palace Ballroom and Theatre. I mentioned earlier, the Palace Ballroom was a magnificent place. And the theatre, it was a very good theatre too. They usually had a review or summer show which lasted the whole summer. The same show for the whole season. And then as you come to the end of the promenade, you came to Derby Castle Theatre and Ballroom. That's on the site of where Summerland is now. But it was a beautiful little variety theatre, typical of the Edwardian, Victorian and Edwardian days, and a beautiful theatre alongside, a ballroom alongside of it. And to get in there, into the theatre and the ballroom, there's some beautiful laid gardens you walk through. And at the end of the gardens, just before going into the theatre, on the left-hand side was a hotel, the Derby Castle Hotel. Now, to go to a show there, you had the best variety that you could expect, and the dancing hall and magnificent ballroom. The entrance was 1 shilling and sixpence. That's 7.5 pence in today's prices. You could either dance, or you could go to the show, or you could go to the show and then dance afterwards. I never missed going there in the summer season, every summer season, because all the old turns were there, they were top of the bill. And another good thing I liked about the Derby Castle, at the end of the summer season, the end of September, when the summer usually finished in the Isle of Man, then, and they have what they call the Manx Melia. The night that the theatre and ballroom closed down, the ballroom was absolutely decorated throughout with farm produce and fruit, bread made like sheaves of corn, carrots, turnips, tomatoes, apples, everything you could imagine was all piled around the side. And then at midnight, they played Auld Lang Syne, and everyone went mad and threw the fruit about and vegetables. It was a real madhouse. That was the Manx Melia. That was the end of the summer season. And then it started what one called the Manx Wakes, when the Manx people took their holidays. But what a great place. And just at the back of the town was Cunningham's Camp, a holiday camp since before the First World War. I think I'm right in saying it was the first holiday camp in history, at least in England. It was started by a family or a man named Cunningham before the 1914 war. What year I can't recall, but it was used as a prison of war camp in the First World War. So how many years that had been going before that, I don't know. But between the wars, it used to be regularly packed. But it was men only. There were no families at the holiday camp, but you only had allowed men, no women, just men. And these chaps, when they come over and went up to the camp, they used to buy fezzes. You know, Egyptian fezzes, like Tommy Cooper wore. You could always tell a camper by his fez. And they used to gather in bunches marching along the promenade. Sometimes they'd be in line ahead, perhaps 20 or 30 chaps walking behind one another, each one with a hand on the previous chap's shoulder. They used to weave in and out of the crowds on the promenade. Sometimes they'd grab hold of girls and pull them with them. But everyone was in the spirit. It was a real holiday spirit. And they had a ballroom at Cunningham's Camp. They could take girls to the ballroom, but once the dance was finished, all the girls had to go. But Douglas's Hilly, and right behind the promenade and Strand Street, as I've just been describing, no matter which way you went, you had to go up a hill to the top of the town. And then behind the town, you could see the hills, Snaefell, and all the different hills in the distance behind the town. It's a beautiful sight, a beautiful place. And the bay is a crescent shaped. Some people say it's like the Bay of Naples. On the south side is Douglas Head, and the far side is Onken Head. Now, both headlands, before the war, were centres of amusement too. On Douglas Head, there was a Pirio show, open air, and a hotel where they used to have singing and music. And from the pier, the Victoria Pier, ran two ferries. They were square-shaped. Well, almost square, slightly oblong, but straight. They had no bow or stern like a ship. And they carried quite a few passengers, I'd say a couple of hundred passengers at a time. A steam, they were run by steam, and they ran between Douglas Victoria Pier and the breakwater at the bottom of Douglas Head. The fare used to be 2 pence. Also, there were rowing boat ferries, 2 quite big rowing boats, which used to ferry holidaymakers across too. But on these ferries, they had a piano and a pianist playing, and on one of them was a man who played a violin. His name was Johnny Ventro. He was an Italian, I'm sure, quite a plump man. And he played all the songs of the day, and eventually, I remember, they had a set of drums as well. I know they had a set of drums because many years later, at the start of the Second World War, I bought that set of drums off Mr. Ventro when I started a dance band, so I remember those drums. And they used to ferry the people across. And on Sundays up on Douglas Head, they used to have an open-air service at this little stage where they had the concert party playing. And it was very well attended. It used to be crowded. And of course, the camera obscura, which is still standing today, that attracted a lot of people. And from the top of Douglas Head, you could get an electric tram, which took you around the cliff face, right round to Port Sodrick. 3 or 4 miles. But it was quite popular run. And also, along a place called the Marine Drive. But also, there were horses and traps, as they called them in those days, or landaus, some people called them. You could go in a trap, horse and trap around to Port Sodrick. On Onken Head, there was a fairground with a figure eight and all sorts of sideshows and a little theatre. For a few years before the Second World War, Sandy Powell played there. He was a well-known radio star, Sandy Powell. He came from Yorkshire, and his catchword was, "Can you hear me, mother?" Well, he played there for maybe 3 or 4 years. And right on the headland, there was a big hotel, the Douglas Bay Hotel, which was very popular. But that has been knocked down, and so has the fairgrounds disappeared, and flats have appeared there now. We used to sing this song when I went to school. Ellen Vannon, a Manx song. My own dear Ellen Vannon, with its green hills by the sea. But there's not so many green hills now. They're being built on. Every hill by the seaside has houses on now. But all these things, it was an amazing period to live in. And the thing that amazed me, it was during the Depression years, and yet Cunningham's camp was full every year. And yet we used to read on the island about all these men in England on the dole. So how they came to be on the dole and come on holidays to Cunningham's camp, I'll never know. Because there was no dole in the Isle of Man, no unemployment pay. If you were out of work, you were out of work. The end of the summer season, the corporation used to give so many jobs to men to repair the roads. If they didn't want to repair the roads, that was it. You got no money. And those who had no work at all, they gave them vouchers for groceries and a bag of coal. No money, just vouchers for the essentials. Which I think may have sounded hard, but it was a good thing, I think, in many ways. And the whole scene of Douglas used to become even more beautiful at night, when all the lit lights, right from the pierhead, right along to Onken, came on, all different coloured lights. And it was a magnificent sight to sail into from the mainland if you came in on a boat arriving after dark, to see all the lights. Absolutely amazing. They have the same lights today, but it doesn't seem the same somehow. I love Douglas. I always have done. A year or so after we went to Hillside Avenue to live, my brother got married to Eileen Waters, and they lived with us for a couple of years. Their eldest boy was born living with us. And then they moved, and they got a house up in Onken, just outside Douglas, to live. And it was due after they'd gone that my mother started taking theatricals who were appearing in the shows to lodge with us. The first one she had was a woman. She was the star of the review at the Palace Theatre. Winnie Collins, her name was, and her husband was the choreographer. And they had a little dog, a little terrier with them. And they asked me if I would look after the dog while they were at the shows. And they gave me, I think it was 2 shillings a week or something like that, to look after this little dog. It was called Lucky, little fox terrier. I'll never forget him. And then another chap we had staying with us was a tap dancer another year. His name was Clifford Seagrave. Now, he was a nephew of Major Seagrave, who was a motor racing driver. In the early 30s, he broke the world land speed record in a racing car. I think it was called the Golden Arrow. That's right, the Golden Arrow. Major Seagrave. Well, he was an uncle of this young lad who was a tap dancer in the show. And then another year, we had a woman. Her real name was called Frank Cass, but she called herself Gloriana. She played the piano accordion, and she was producing the show. It travelled all over the British Isles. It was called Casey's Court. It was a comedy musical show. Gloriana, she was a wonderful woman. She got to be very friendly with my mother, and she corresponded with us for years after. And then...